Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in South Asia, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Sneha Anavarapu, and I am the host of this channel. Today, I'm thrilled to be in conversation with Dr. Adam Auerbach, who, along with Dr. Tariq Tachil, is the author of the book Migrants and Machine Politics, which was published by Princeton University Press in 2023. Dr. Auerbach is an associate professor at the School of International Service at American University, and Dr. Tariq Tachil is Professor of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania.
Thank you so much, Adam, for taking time out to chat with me today. Once again, my congratulations on this achievement of a book. I really wish Tariq could join us, but alas, it's really hard to coordinate across three different schedules. And anyway, I'm just so glad to get a chance to chat with at least one of you about your brilliant book.
Oh, thank you so much. And please let me just start by thanking you for having me on the New Books Network podcast. It's really especially exciting to be in conversation with a scholar, you know, doing such exciting work on urban India. So really looking forward to the conversation.
Thank you so much, Adam. You're too kind. Before we begin talking about migrants and machine politics, I would love to get to know you a little more. Could you tell us a little bit about your academic journey? How did you become a political scientist and how you got interested specifically in urban politics and local governance? And, I would love for you to speak a little bit about your first book, Demanding Development, which I absolutely loved and was so inspired by.
Oh, thank you so much. And that's such a fun question. If I can go, I guess, way back to college. And actually, this is someone that Professor Mike Maniates, a professor of mine in college, just really inspired me, not only to, care and think about, politics, political economy, especially everyday politics, how people seek to advance, their well-being and security, but also South Asian studies in India in particular. He really encouraged me to go and study in India in college, which I did. I studied in Jaipur for 3 or 4 months and just was just absolutely fascinated by society and politics in the city. And it really solidified, not only my interest, again, in politics and society in India, but also, learning Hindi. It really wasn't until graduate school. I did my graduate work at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and there was a really great opportunity during my third year to do an internship, even as a PhD student. And I did it at the National Institute for Urban Affairs in Delhi. And I really feel like that put me, it gave me really sort of a front seat view of how JNNURM, a large, urban development program that unfolded in the 2000s in India, how it was working. We were getting all this survey data back from cities throughout India, particularly on informal settlements, slum and squatter settlements, their levels of access to basic public goods and services, in addition to indicators of sort of governance quality across cities. And it just really struck me that not only across cities, but even within individual wards and cities and across neighborhoods, across informal settlements, there was just immense unevenness in the extent to which sort of the municipality or state had extended things like water, roads, electricity, streetlights. So it really made me curious, what is driving these sort of disparities across these settlements? that otherwise face so many common vulnerabilities stemming from, you know, weaker absent property rights, you know, vulnerable locations within cities, you know, along riverbeds or mountainsides, along railroad tracks. What is the politics behind this unevenness? And so, you know, again, through more sort of pre-dissertation field work in Jaipur and Delhi, you know, I simply started going to, you know, some of these informal settlements, you know, Jhugi Jhopadis in Delhi, Kachi Bustis in Jaipur, these different names for slum and squatter settlements. And it just struck me how rich these forms of informal governance were within these communities, that there were sort of crystallized, identifiable, informal leaders. They were doing activities to mixed levels of success, to try to stop eviction and get access to these basic public goods and services. So this really sort of like launched me into, you know, what became my dissertation. And then my first book, Demanding Development, that, you know, the central puzzle and question of it really is to try to understand what explains this variation in public goods and services. And, you know, what I arrive at, you know, in the book, you know, based on, you know, 2 years of, you know, ethnographic fieldwork and, you know, a large survey across over 100 settlements in Jaipur and Bhopal, the two cities that I ultimately ended up studying, was that we, you know, we really need to look at the internal political organization of these settlements, in particular, the ways that they're connected through political party organizational networks to larger party organizations in the city. So, yeah, that's... you know, sort of the book, you know, and journey in a nutshell.
Thank you. That was really, really helpful to anchor our conversation about your new book as well. And I would love to know, how did you come up with the idea for this particular book project, Migrants and Machine Politics? How did it all begin? And how did you end up working with Tariq, your co-author, on this? And I guess, why did you end up anchoring your study in Jaipur and Bhopal? Was it a continuation of Demanding Development's study?
Yeah, absolutely. So, no, it's fun thinking back, like, yeah, now, like, you know, what is a decade? It's amazing how time flies. But, you know, right after I'd finished my dissertation, Tariq, you know, who I had not met at that point, also had begun studying, you know, politics and informality in India's cities, you know, in particular through the lens of examining circular migrants in India. As you know, there's an enormous population of over 100 million people who go back and forth between the countryside and the city to find employment. And so he was really engaged in this, you know, really exciting research agenda and trying to understand how these circular migrants cooperate or don't cooperate in the city. You know, what is the role of, you know, ethnicity in that cooperation? And at the same time, I, you know, was working on turning Demanding Development into a book. And so we got in touch and just started, you know, talking about all of these, you know, sort of issues. And, you know, we're jointly sort of fascinated in questions that ultimately ended up animating migrants and machine politics. You know, how are these informal leaders in informal slum settlements, how do they emerge? You know, a lot of these settlements are, you know, 20, 30, 40 years old. Some are much, much newer. You know, squatter settlements in particular are largely a post-independence phenomenon. But, you know, these low-income migrants moving to the city, you know, At its origins, you know, there aren't crystallized sort of forms of leadership. So how does this develop? How do these networks that, you know, have been examined in the city that do all these bridging activities for the urban poor, how are they constructed in the first place? So, yeah, we started off, you know, trying to understand leadership formation, and then that sort of turned into understanding leadership responsiveness to residents. We were going to do joint field work, you know, in 2015, 16, 17, sort of like every summer there, you know, we were in Jaipur or Bhopal together. And I think, you know, in addition to being interested in the themes that underpin the book, I think both of us, you know, derive a lot of inspiration and energy from doing field work. You know, we both love field work and really enjoyed, you know, doing field work, you know, together. And yeah, just, you know, one article became another article. And, you know, we sort of amassed so much data. And, you know, after years of field work and, you know, conversations and writing, that we decided to, you know, launch into writing, you know, the larger book based on all of this work that we had done together. And why Jaipur and Bhopal? It's such an interesting, question. You know, as you know, I mean, there's, you know, over, you know, probably at this point, over 60 million plus cities in India, an enormous constellation of cities under 1 million people. It was tough. And I remember being asked this a lot, even in graduate school, you know, motivate your case. Like, why are you going here? And like, I always wanted to answer that question by like, well, I need to go somewhere and I can't go everywhere. And every city seems different in lots of different ways. So I'm not quite sure how to sort of explain this. But I mean, ultimately, yeah, I mean, there's certainly sort of path dependencies in this. You know, going all the way back to college, I had studied in Jaipur. I felt like I got to know the city really well. I had invested a lot of time in learning Hindi, and Tariq, of course, is fluent in Hindi. And so I think, you know, because we wanted to do ethnography and interviews and intensive qualitative work, we were going to go somewhere in sort of the Hindi speaking belt. Because of prior institutional connections and, you know, personal, you know, connections and friendships, Jaipur seems like a great place to go. Bhopal is another capital city of an adjacent state with a little bit less of a population than Jaipur, but, you know, similar along a number, you know, of respects, along a number of factors, you know, as Jaipur. And I think another thing is, I mean, going anywhere, you know, could be, you know, important, and thinking about it comparatively is important. But I think both of us were interested in going to places like Jaipur and Bhopal that are a little bit smaller. There's a lot of work, in Delhi and Mumbai and Kolkata and Bangalore, and for good reason. Those are big, important cities, and there still needs to be much more work done on those. But most people living in informal settlements in India do not live in one of the mega cities. They live in one of these medium-sized cities or these much smaller sort of towns and cities spread throughout the country. And so while every sort of state and city is going to have its, you know, idiosyncrasies, we thought it'd be interesting to sort of bend our empirical work towards something that is perhaps a little bit more representative, of sort of the average experience of people living in these settlements.
No, I'm so glad that you brought that up, because that was one of the first thoughts that I had, even while reading Demanding Development, that it is a bit, I think, refreshing, if I can say that, to read about urban politics that is not centered in either Mumbai or Delhi or Chennai, Bangalore, Calcutta. And I think this book too does a great job in making us think about cities that are not the mega cities that are over. I don't mean to say overrepresented in a bad way, but definitely represented by a lot in academic literature, at least. So the book is based on such an interesting mix of ethnography and experimental methods. Can you say a bit more about how you went about collecting data for this book project? What were some of the issues you ran up against? And what did blending ethnography with experiments enable you to see as researchers?
Yeah. Oh, thank you so much for asking that. And, you know, to go back to something that I said a little bit earlier, I think both of us really like to think of ourselves as, and I know I can speak for Tariq with this, like mixed methods researchers, because, you know, we really think that, each of these approaches, has really unique strengths. And we think that their combination can illuminate a lot. Sustained ethnography and interviews really just opened up this world to us in such an empirically rich way. Of course, there's a huge literature, on informal settlements in India and elsewhere. But we really wanted to, ground ourselves in understanding process, history, the formation of these networks, how people interface with the states, ways that are quite difficult to do in sort of a cross-sectional survey, which has its own strengths, and that's the reason why we did that as well. This is both for my sort of first book, Demanding Development, and the current book, you know, the importance of understanding process, the formation of identities, why people are doing certain things. One of the most fascinating, sources of data that we encountered that ended up becoming really foundational to our book and my earlier book as well, is what we refer to as informal archives. These informal leaders in India's slum settlements obsessively keep documentation over the course of decades on their correspondence with officials, petitions asking for, water, electricity, roads, streetlights, asking not to be, evicted. community meeting notes. Most of these communities in Jaipur and Bhopal, you know, have their own Vikas Samiti or Moldaha Sudharan Samiti. So these development associations, these development councils, where people have, you know, keep notebooks of community meeting, you know, notes, you know, political ephemera, you know, old, you know, party manifestos and posters from, you know, two or three decades ago. And so we ended up collecting over 3,000 of these documents across a large number of case study settlements, you know, that allowed us to triangulate alongside oral histories, you know, to really get a sense of the micro histories of these communities, you know, for which, you know, you would never be able to go to a formal archive, you know, and reconstruct the history of, you know, whatever settlement you're studying in either these cities or elsewhere. So, you know, the qualitative was just absolutely foundational. And it wasn't just in the service of getting to the quantitative and getting better quantitative data. It was essential and important. And, you know, I think, you know, I think I can speak for Tariq, our sort of favorite activity, you know, in the book. But we did want to compare. We wanted to go beyond a few settlements to look at patterns. And so we, you know, also did sort of large scale quantitative surveys across 110 settlements in the two cities to be able to see, you know, are our qualitative insights extending to a larger number of settlements. And we also do survey experiments in the book to allow us to be on firmer ground to make sort of causal statements about why people are making certain selections and decisions in the formation of these political networks in India's cities. But ultimately, you know, it really allowed us to sort of really triangulate across a large number and diverse number of sort of data sources so that we felt more comfortable to hang our hat on certain findings.
Yeah, and I was very curious to know, were there any learnings from this, any faux pas that were made that you had to sort of go back and think about when you were designing the study and executing it?
That's so funny. I mean, certainly like doing field work together and, you know, even when we were doing the surveys, you know, it was really important to us to be with the survey team every single day in the field. You know, this, of course, you know, and this was a great privilege that we were able to do this. And I don't think it was like, we're both sort of obsessive and wanted to micromanage. I think we like, you know, for morale, and, you know, wanting to learn from the survey as it was unfolding. And certainly to, you know, to make sure that the sampling process was unfolding correctly. You know, we were with the team every day. Like all these months of fieldwork together, there was definitely, you know, a lot of laughs. Not necessarily about the fieldwork itself, but yeah, I think we, you know, we have, you know, fun doing fieldwork together. So yeah, no, I mean, I can't think of, and I would tell you, I can't think of any like super goofy sort of faux pas, you know, in the data collection itself. But I think, you know, again, you know, to go back and, you know, to the importance of the qualitative fieldwork, I think both of us would have been nervous, and this is a style thing, but I think both of us would have been nervous if we had just sort of like showed up and done a big survey, and not really sort of known, you know, how are these communities sort of organizing themselves? How do they make claims on the state? So I think it minimized, you know, some of that sort of, you know, ambiguity about like, what are we doing? And are we measuring things the way that we should be measuring it? You know, it really sort of, yeah, the qualitative part, I think really sort of, you know, grounded, you know, the quantitative work then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it really shows the way the two methods have been blended into a narrative in the book. And one thing that I really enjoyed about Migrants and Machine Politics was it was so well written and so engaging. And especially as someone who, I get very intimidated by quanti anything. So I will admit that when I started reading the book, I had a moment of apprehension where I was like, will I understand some of the more quantitative sort of analyses? But I think it's really a testament to how well written the book is that I didn't feel a sense of alienation from the data at any point, because I felt like both of you were sort of guiding the analysis with explanations and, you know, careful reminders of what we are to see and glean from the data really, really well. But yeah, so, you know, it was great. And I can't wait to teach a few excerpts from this book, because I feel like it does such a great job at capturing the best of both the methods, and is so engagingly written. So Migrants and Machine Politics substantively tackles such a key question at the heart of social and political trajectory of cities in the global south, which is that how do poor migrants get politically incorporated into big growing cities? In particular, the book delves rigorously into probing how informal authority emerges in slum settlements, what the role of brokers is in mediating political equations, and how slum leaders connect to parties and bureaucracies within the city. All very familiar questions and issues that have been at the heart of urban scholarship and at the heart of everyday working in cities, but also have become the stuff of gritty films and web series that capture the underbelly of life in Indian cities, right? But one of the most important interventions you make in the book is both theoretical and methodological, of course, is that you approach a study of the urban political machinery from the grassroots level. In other words, rather than viewing urban poor as being passively subject to the power play of elites, the book reveals rather vividly unacknowledged forms of agency amongst the urban poor. That the book does this while also accounting for the systematic state exclusion and repression that shapes the lives of urban poor migrants is very compelling. So could you speak a little bit about how the book conceptualizes a framework for the study of urban politics from a grassroots level, and what leverage does that give researchers analytically speaking?
Thank you so much. And you know, thank you for the kind words about the book. I mean, it means a great deal coming from you. The book, its orientation is very much sort of from the ground up. Tariq and I are both political scientists, and you know, the two key literatures that we speak to in the book are those on urban party machines. And this literature, you know, as a sociologist, coming out of Chicago, I'm sure you're very well aware of, you know, what is now almost a century of studies on urban party machines, going back to, these studies on, Tammany Hall, the Democratic Party machine in New York City. In addition to, a literature that's quite close to that, the literature on clientelism and distributed politics, both of these literatures, have made, really important contributions to our understandings of distributed politics and representation and development. But overwhelmingly, they approach these structures and the relationship between sort of party elites and brokers and the urban poor from the top down, in particular through an understanding of the importance of enforcement. So as you know, and this is absolutely not unique to Indian cities, there's work on this, incredible work on, cities in Latin America, Southern Europe, the United States, Sub-Saharan Africa, that in cities, parties oftentimes see and approach the urban poor as communities of highly vulnerable people with which to exchange, basic services, jobs, security from eviction for the vote. And so this quid pro quo emerges between the urban poor and political parties that is both symbiotic, but is also incredibly asymmetrical, giving sort of, small extensions of, services or other acts of much more mundane forms of vote buying, in the Indian context, bottles of desi daru, country liquor, cash. So certainly these sort of activities are happening. But what this larger sort of literature collectively sort of renders is an urban poor and low-income voters that are sort of locked in these very sort of rigid clientelistic relationships where they're being targeted for things and are expected to turn out at the ballot box and support that party. And there's brokers involved that will mobilize voters. But it's very sort of top-down in orientation, focused on how can we make sure that voters are returning the favor at the ballot box if we extend them these things in these clientelistic relationships. And so our qualitative fieldwork, our ethnographic fieldwork, our interviews really sort of destabilized and ran against the grain of a lot of what we think the conventional sort of thinking is on how these party machines operate. At the same time, both of us, have learned so much from, what I think is a much richer, literature coming from geography, sociology, anthropology on the politics of the urban poor, which really stresses agency. Going back to, for instance, Partha Chatterjee's work on political society, that the urban poor often have to turn to these sort of fragmented, capricious relationships with state actors to get things, and using things like political parties and protests to be able and political intermediaries to get those things. The networks that connect the urban poor to the state are largely sort of seen as this sort of fixed structures that operate just above the urban poor, but are not being shaped by preferences and activities by the urban poor. So our bottom-up framework identifies a number of really key, what we think are key insights into understanding how do these party machine networks form. And then once we understand how they form, it will help us understand how they function. So for example, competition really importantly underpins, each of the chapters in our book, that informal leaders in India's slum settlements need to intensively compete with one another on an everyday basis for the support of residents. And in almost every settlement, there will be multiple informal leaders who are competing with one another. And so what this does is it opens up the door to significant agency and choice by ordinary residents in selecting who am I going to go to or follow in the settlement. And that dynamic helps shape, the very most grassroots intimate base of these party machines in India's cities. Then residents need to compete with one another for the attention of the informal leaders. They are faced with a barrage of problems, as you well know, over getting access to, running water, electricity, getting their children into public schools, finding jobs, dealing with police cases, an endless list of problems that emerge in these neighborhoods. And these informal slum leaders only have so much time and resources. How are they deciding who to select to help? We then go, above the settlements to look at competition among patrons in extending party machine networks, into the settlements. And so looking from the bottom up really reveals intense competition and choice. And what this does then is it structures each of the subsequent chapters in the book, where we sort of break off one piece of the anatomy of the machine from the bottom up and looking at how this competition and selection fuels the emergence of that one part of the network, leading to unanticipated findings that I look forward to sort of talking about that I'm sure we'll get into.
Absolutely. Thanks for setting the stage for our discussion of each of the chapters that I'm really excited to get into. And so chapter 2 of the book delves into one of the most fascinating and ubiquitous figures that keeps slum settlements in the global south moving, the figure of the broker. After you explore how and why political brokers emerge in slum settlements, what were some of the findings that surprised you, and how do these findings speak to popular and academic narratives around brokerage?
Thank you. I mean, the idea of the broker and the specific actor that we study, the slum leader as a broker, is central, of course, to the book. And as you noted, chapter 2 really, looks at the emergence of these actors. Very often in the literature, they're sort of taken as, a static given. There are these people that are kind of good at doing these go-between activities. If you need help navigating the state, there are people that will sort of help you. And these people can also help political parties mobilize voters during elections. How do they come to be in the first place? And informal settlements, slum settlements, are interesting empirical sites to ask this question because they have emerged so rapidly and so recently that we're able to sort of trace the formation of these actors and looking at sort of the staffing changes and changes in the distribution of support across different informal leaders in slums over, just a matter of a few decades. So, I mean, a first surprising thing, and, I'd already, sort of mentioned this, that the importance of residents in selecting their informal leaders. These are not actors that are thrust upon them. Political parties don't parachute these people into settlements. These informal leaders in India's slum settlements, they move and migrate to the settlement just like any other residents. Very, very few of them, we were able to survey about 630 of them across these 110 slum settlements. Very, very few of them had any kind of like political aspirations, before moving to the city that, I'm going to move to the city and move into an informal slum settlement and become a leader. This happens in essence by accident, but because of particular characteristics that they have once they move to the settlement. But how does this, agency and selection sort of unfold? You know, it was fascinating to Tarek and I to see these different pathways through which residents select their informal slum leaders in their settlements. And what we do is we group them into sort of these two pathways. One are these episodic moments, usually in response to a planned eviction or just really intensifying underdevelopments. You know, the nullies, you know, the drains are clogged and overflowing. The monsoon rains came and washed away, you know, part of the road, where people in the community will come together. They'll do like a betak, you know, they'll all sort of sit there and deliberate over who should be their neta or their adyaksh, their informal leader in the settlements. And so one pathway are these episodic moments of people sort of deliberating over who should be their leader. The other pathway are these everyday fluid decisions that individual residents and their families make over, we have a problem, who should we go to in the settlement to help us solve that problem? Because among ordinary residents, there is intense despondency over, am I able to go to the Nagar Nigam, the municipality? Am I able to go to the district collector's office to actually get this thing? Only 12% of our survey respondents thought if they went by themselves to one of these government officials or politicians that they would actually get attention. And so this huge chasm between ordinary residents and the state, creates a demand for these intermediaries. And so people make these everyday decisions over who am I going to turn to and support? And that then generates the distribution of support across informal leaders in the settlement. So what we do, you know, drawing on qualitative data, observational survey data, and experimental data, is try to understand, okay, so if residents have all this agency over picking their informal leaders, what are their preferences for these informal leaders? And we find things that we think are very surprising. So residents do hold preferences to have fellow members of their jati, you know, their subcaste, their religion, and people that have migrated from their state of origin. But most often, they don't have that choice in practice. You might want someone of your jati to be a neta that you can go to in the settlement, but there isn't somebody of your jati that is a leader in the settlement. And so we find these rich, multi-ethnic, you know, inter-caste, inter-religious, inter-sort of state of migration networks that form in these settlements, not necessarily due to sort of a cosmopolitanism, but because of the material compulsions of needing to get things done. And turning to someone that can really help you do that. And just to put a footnote on that, I mean, these settlements are incredibly diverse. The average settlement in our sample has a fractionalization score of 0.8 in terms of its caste, you know, meaning that if you just randomly picked two people out of the average settlement in our sample, there's an 80% chance that they would be of a different jati. That number is about 0.2 for religion. Most settlements in Jaipur and Bhopal that we sampled have both Hindus and Muslims. In Bhopal, there's even settlements with, Ambedkar Buddhists. There are settlements in Jaipur that part of the religious composition is Sikhs. Diversity along the dimension of the state that the migrants have moved from. So in these incredibly diverse contexts, people might have these sort of generalized preferences for people that are like themselves ethnically, but they very rarely have that option. What they're really centered on, and what our most sort of powerful finding is the importance of education among aspiring slum leaders, that this is the most important factor that allows them to successfully understand things like eligibility criteria, writing petitions, navigating state institutions, to help residents in their settlements. And that really sort of trumps, even ethnic considerations, in these communities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for that. That was very useful to note, because in the next chapter, from the emergence of brokers, we move to figuring out the patterned logics that dictate which slum residents brokers choose to assist. I found this chapter to be very compelling, as it really highlighted how the priorities of brokers had a lot to do with their own ambitions around their political careers, and how much brokers thought about their own reputations with regard to what you call cultivating clients. Could you say a little more about how these careerist ambitions work alongside or against perhaps more apparent factors such as religion, caste, and ethnicity in determining who slum brokers favor and who they do not?
I'm so glad you asked this. And continuing with the theme of these brokers, so much of the literature, especially from political science, centers on election time activities. And certainly these settlements, really come to life politically, during election season. You'll see, graffiti of the open hand of the Congress Party, the kamal, the lotus flower of the BJP. Posters are plastered everywhere. Candidates are coming and giving speeches. And these slum brokers, these informal leaders, are really central to mobilizing residents and organizing these events and talking to people. But what we find is what's going on in between elections is much more important to understanding both the rise of these informal leaders as well as their responsiveness downward to residents, which, as you note, is really sort of the motivation of Chapter 3. Once these actors bubble up into this position, what shapes their decision-making around who to help in their neighborhood, given their limited time and resources? So these slum brokers, they are, very entrepreneurial and careerist. They have aspirations. Very few of them will ultimately end up moving out of the settlements, but they have hopes to someday get a party ticket, in particular to fight in a municipal election. Not once have we come across an example where a popular slum leader was given a ticket to fight in an assembly constituency for a state election, in large part because of the incredible amounts of money that is required to fight in state elections. I mean, even municipal elections are quite expensive and can involve, lakhs and lakhs of rupees. But it is within the reach of the most popular slum leaders, particularly those residing in large settlements, to get a ticket to fight in an election. But other slum leaders wanted to move up the party hierarchy, building more namcheen, more sort of social prominence for themselves, getting more goodies for their increased popularity and position. These are very complex, individuals where it's easy to sort of brush aside their activities as just sort of rent seeking. And they do a lot of that. If a resident comes to them and asks for help getting a ration card, that could be 500-600 rupees. And if you ask the, informal slum leader about this, they'll say, look, if I'm going to spend an entire afternoon at the district collector's office, why should I not be compensated for that? So they get this everyday sort of stream of rents from helping residents. During elections, they can often get quite handsome amounts of money by doing voter mobilization activities in their settlements. But they're also residents of the settlement. So they'll say, look, like I also want a paved road to drive over. I don't want to drive over a dirt road. I want the teacher to show up and teach my kids. So they have multiple sort of, reasons for doing the activities that they do. But in thinking about sort of their long-term prospects, they want to, and this is really what Chapter 3 is about, expand and solidify their reputation for being effective problem solvers in the settlements. That they're not just sort of targeting a narrow plurality of people in the community. These are not political constituencies. The hope is to get everybody behind you in the settlements. And so what this does is it creates a politics that generates what we think are some surprising findings. So settlement leaders deliberately avoid cultivating a reputation for only helping their narrow jati, for example, their subcaste. They will deliberately go out of their way to weave together multi-ethnic coalitions within the settlements. Because these places are so diverse, if you seek to only build support among your narrow group, that's only going to take you so far. And so not only through sort of our survey experiments, but also through observational survey data, asking and observing settlement leaders and the people that they're helping, Hindu slum leaders are assisting Muslim slum residents and vice versa. People of different castes are assisting one another. Again, stemming from the compulsions of wanting to get stuff done on behalf of residents and the desire to build as broad of a base of support among slum leaders as possible. Also, in deciding who to prioritize in the settlements, looking towards those residents who have the loudest sort of speaker, have the best ability to broadcast their reputation for being a good problem solver. And so they disproportionately will favor and prioritize, for example, residents that have been in the settlement for longer than newer arrivals, because those people who have been in the settlement for longer tend to have denser social networks within the community, have greater sort of social standing. And so by helping them, you're sort of, you know, getting the rumor mill to help you in a more expansive way than someone that had just arrived that has fewer friends and connections in the settlement. They're also more likely to target people like, you know, the Pan and Bibi Wala, you know, outside of the settlement, or the Dukandar at the Kirana Dukan, you know, the small shopkeeper in the settlement, because, you know, these are, you know, as I'm sure you've seen many times yourself, sort of, you know, the centers of social life and gossip in the community. So they're very careful about crafting their reputations and allocating their time and resources in ways that expand their reputation to become as popular as possible, because that is the currency that they use to exchange for patronage from parties and that fuels their rise within party organizations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. And going beyond the confines of the settlement or the addas that emerge at the you know, chai stalls or pan shops, chapter 4 tackles a different aspect of the political machine, the factors that decide the selection of local brokers by party patrons for formal inclusion within the party organization. You argue that competition and rivalry shape these choices, but also that the structure of competition is not specific to any one political party. So this similar structure of competition plays out whether it's BJP or Congress, right? So I would love for you to say a little bit here about the factors that determine the selection of local brokers as party candidates and why paying attention to this mechanism matters to studies of urban politics broadly. What are the stakes, in other words, of paying attention to this linkage between local brokers and party candidates?
Oh, thank you. So, you know, this is really a part of the book where we then pivot out of the micro world of politics within the settlements and consider how those communities are then being connected to the larger currents of politics in the city. So in this chapter, as you note, you know, we surveyed over 300 ward councillors and politicians at the city level to understand through their eyes then, in this sequential construction of party machines, how do they extend limited party positions among what is ultimately an army of potential political brokers in their constituency? So, you know, the average ward size in Jaipur is about 25,000 people. It's a little bit smaller in Bhopal. But even in the average ward, which is obviously relatively smaller than an assembly constituency at the state level, there's usually multiple informal slum settlements in that ward. And there's going to be dozens, if not literally hundreds, of informal slum leaders that they could be extending their networks to. And you know, these party positions are very coveted among informal slum leaders, and they're scarce by design. You know, we had one party leader in the city tell us, you know, we can't just hand these positions out like prasad, you know, sort of religious offerings. We need to, you know, there can only be one, you know, president of the BJP at the booth or the block. You know, there can only be so many treasurers or vice presidents, these different organizational positions, which within each one of these committees within the party's organization in the city. So competition among for these positions is intense among India's slum leaders, which begs the question then of if we go out of the settlements and look at the decisions of political patrons in the city, how are they allocating these positions? So our theoretical framework in the chapter really focuses on these sort of trade-offs and thinking around, is this person going to be loyal, not only to our party brand, but to me as an individual? You know, as you know, once you sort of open up the black box of the political party in India's cities and certainly outside of India's cities, factionalism is rampant. You know, people have, you know, their own sort of personal followings, even within the party sort of structure. There are sort of, you know, fragmented factions all the way down to the grassroots. So loyalty is not only understood in terms of, you know, is this person going to be a BJP loyalist or is this person going to be a Congress loyalist? But is this person going to be personally loyal to me and assist me in my upward climb in the party? separate from that are ideas of efficacy. You know, is this person effective in mobilizing voters? But also, is this person have efficacy in terms of being popular among residents? So again, drawing on sort of our qualitative fieldwork and our surveys, we find what we think are really interesting findings about what the preferences are among these political patrons in the city over selecting informal slum leaders. First, they prioritize people that share their own narrow jati, unlike the decision-making that goes on within the settlement itself, which we see as sort of strong evidence for wanting to have sort of personal loyalties, that there's sort of a large literature, not only just in India, but elsewhere, that shows the importance of ethnicity as a heuristic, that this person belongs to my group. We have sort of shared sort of norms and understandings of reciprocity, and this that this can sort of grease the wheels of exchange between the two of us. Perhaps not surprisingly, finds, the co-partisans are favored. So people also, patrons also place importance on the person being a party sort of loyalist. But also interestingly, we find that they also emphasize the education of informal slum leaders. And in digging into this deeper qualitatively, we find that these patrons in the city are well aware of what the ingredients are that makes for a popular slum leader. Because ultimately, they want to give these positions to people that are popular, because that popularity is going to help that person mobilize voters behind them. And so they realize that education is so important in underpinning efficacy and claim making, that they too place emphasis on that as well, knowing the preferences of ordinary residents. And they see this on a daily basis. If you're sitting around in a ward counselor's office, there will be a stream of brokers coming either by themselves or alongside residents to ask the ward counselor for resources or help with something. And they get a clear sense of the qualities of these informal slum leaders as people that are more educated on average than the average resident. They are the ones writing the petitions. They are the ones pointing to different sort of state programs that residents want access to. And so this is yet another sort of data point in emphasizing the importance of education, which is such a key sort of factor in shaping efficacy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the final chapter of the book tackles the final piece of the puzzle moving from this particular part of the urban political machine to then thinking about what determines whether a petition for local public goods will ultimately be successful, right? And this really gets at the heart of, I guess, the final destination of how urban poor seek political representation and responsiveness. So who gets excluded and by what logics? You argue that credit claiming is a core mechanism through which politicians make decisions on what petitions to deem deserving of a response. Can you say a bit more about how this credit claiming works and what complementary processes affect decisions of urban politicians with regard to which local public goods or asks to support?
Yeah, absolutely. So, so this last empirical chapter, as you just described, looks at this sort of final decision-making sort of points of these ward counselors also have limited resources and time. How are they allocating their responsiveness across different settlements in the city? A theoretical intervention that we seek to make in the chapter is this, emerging literature on state and political responsiveness oftentimes looks at sort of the claims of individuals that are unmediated for private benefits for themselves. But so much of politics and development in these communities revolves around group-based claims. Groups or the entire community asking for things like a road or a series of streetlights or a new water tank or a ration card camp. Building on the rest of the book, very often those claims are being mediated. So what shapes political responsiveness when politicians need to consider not only the request being made, but the broker who's making that request, as well as the neighborhood that broker is coming from? So it's sort of this three-level decision. So exactly as you noted, credit claiming really sort of shines through both in terms of our findings, but also our theoretical expectations. I'd be curious to hear if you've seen similar things in Hyderabad, But the, you know, the landscape, the physical built space is littered with efforts at credit claiming by politicians in slum settlements. You walk up on a settlement and there'll be, you know, a huge sign noting that, you know, this politician, the MLA or the ward counselor has given this much money to pave this road or build this navi, or they will plaster a poster or spray paint a water tank. You know, when a new school is built or a mandir, you know, a temple is being inaugurated, they will be sure to be there at the ribbon cutting ceremony, giving a speech, handing out, you know, food. All of these efforts to cut through all of the potential ambiguity of who gave me this thing through the eyes of residents. Yeah, I mean, when, you know, given the complexity and the nebulous nature of the states, you know, if you ask residents, you know, where did this water tap come from? You might oftentimes get the response, well, the Sarkar, you know, the government gave it to us. Well, the Sarkar could be a lot of things. I mean, it could be, you know, the ward counselor, the MLA, it could be the Jalbawan, you know, the waterworks, you know, it could be any number of sort of bureaucrats, politicians, or the institutions in which they work. And so politicians want to cut through that confusion and say, I am the one that gave this to you. And so what we find, building on our qualitative fieldwork and our surveys, is that those goods that lend themselves to having this ambiguity cut through, that can be easily tagged and durably tagged. So things that can be tagged with the politician's name and things that will be in the settlements for a long period of time that residents are constantly interacting with are privileged over those things that are more short-term and sort of effuse in their provision. You know, so for example, like a ration card camp, would be less favored, for instance, than a water tank. A water tank, everybody's going to go there every single day. They're going to see the politician's name every single day, and that water tank probably isn't going to go anywhere. A ration card camp is important, and it gives the politicians some opportunities to show up and say, hey, I'm setting up this camp, and now you all have access to subsidized food and fuel, those of you that are eligible for the ration card. But it's going to be a one-day thing, and then it's gone. So credit claiming, based on the physical characteristics of the good, looms large in driving the responsiveness of politicians to the claims of these brokers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. And I just like really appreciated how each chapter was so interconnected and interlinked and really like spoke back to the findings from previous chapters and giving us this sort of holistic picture of the urban political machine. With such, I think, sincerity to detail. And so again, congratulations on the book. And thank you so much for taking time out to chat with me today. But before I let you go, I would love to know what you're working on right now and what newer work we can hope to read by you in the future.
Oh, thanks. So, yeah, lots of, at least I think, are, you know, exciting projects sort of unfolding at the moment. So, yeah, I think like three sort of bigger things at the moment. I guess Tarek is not sick of me yet. So the two of us, along with Shikhar Singh, who just finished his PhD in political science at Yale, the three of us are working on, you know, a large project on local governance in India's small towns. So there's, as we sort of discussed at the very beginning of the conversation, there's this massive population of towns, you know, under 500,000 people, under 100,000 people, that actually house, depending on what you use as the cutoff, about half or even more of India's urban population. And so India's urban story, at least half of it is happening in these, you know, quite small towns that fall under India's 74th constitutional amendment. They're governed as urban spaces, but they've been marginalized largely in terms of investments by the state. Their political economies are much different. Their built space is much different. Their demographics and migratory patterns are much different. And so we're centering this new sort of research agenda on politics and governance in India's small towns. So we recently finished a large survey of politicians across 60 of Rajasthan's nagarpalikas, which are the smallest sort of urban units of government. And we'll be doing a large survey this summer across citizens, politicians, and bureaucrats in Rajasthan's nagarpalikas to understand a range of different issues, one of which is this really surprising underspending that occurs in the average small town. That these towns, as you know, most of their sort of revenue comes from fiscal transfers from state governments and the central government. There's quite little sort of own source revenue collection through taxation and fee collection in these towns. But many of these towns are spending significantly less than what they have like in the coffers. And that's particularly surprising to us during our qualitative fieldwork. It's not because of a lack of want. Roads need to be paved, lack of sewer systems and drainage, but there's money sitting in bank accounts. Why is this happening? So much of the project will revolve around understanding sort of local capacity over governance and public spending in these little towns, as well as several other themes. So yeah, look forward to keeping you updated on that. Another project that I'm doing with Tanu Kumar at the Claremont Graduate University is on politics in India's urban periphery. Again, as you know, it's so exciting to talk to a sort of a fellow, urban studies scholar. The edges of India's cities are rapidly transforming in terms of their built space, governance over lands, their demographics. And so in Jaipur, we've been studying what we're referring to as peripheral private developments. These private developers at the outskirts of the city, buying large plots of land from farmers, dividing up the land into neighborhoods with gridded roads, very sort of middle class in nature. But the Jaipur Vikas Pradhikaran, the development authority, is very unevenly absorbing these neighborhoods into the formal governance structures of the city and unevenly extending services to these neighborhoods. And again, these neighborhoods differ from, slum and squatter settlements in many ways. Most importantly, they're sort of their origins in sort of this planned yet still sort of informal way, as well as the demographics of residents within them and the pathways that they seek authorization from the urban development authority. So this project will look at that, as well as this other sort of cast of actors that are so important at fueling the transformation of land at the urban periphery, including the boom mafia, the land mafia, and this deep nexus between sort of these land brokers, the land mafia, as well as local politicians. Then the third and sort of final thing that I'm working on that will hopefully become sort of my a solo book project of mine is actually not in cities, quite the opposite. I've become really fascinated in India's Forest Rights Act of 2006. Which I was really inspired by looking into this, honestly, spending so much time in Bhopal, where there's a considerably large Adivasi population in many of the informal settlements, including Gond Adivasi, describing, this thing that's going on where, we're able to make a claim for a patta in our village in the forest for the first time ever. The British essentially rendered large swaths of people residing in forests as encroachers in the 1870s, 1880s, during the rise of imperial forestry. That in many ways has been like wholly carried over even after independence. We've gone through these different periods of joint forest management and other sort of, governance forms in India's forests. After the launch of the 2006 Forest Rights Act, there's been this really surprising variation, stretching all the way from eastern Gujarat all the way up into the northeast, of unevenness in the success with which people residing in forests, not just Adivasis, have been able to actually secure a title for themselves or their village. But I'm also just interested in how this is transforming local state-society relations in India's forest lands, particularly between people residing in the forest and the forest department. Which is sort of the primary sort of face of the state to many people residing in forest land. So, I've already been able to do sort of archival work for this in Delhi and London, and I'm hoping to do sort of more ethnographic field work, in the coming year or so.
Yeah, I mean, all the three projects sounds really, really fascinating. But I did a double take when you talked about not doing urban politics stuff for your solo book project. But the forest rights project sounds really, really interesting. And I'm so excited to read more of your work and all of these three projects hold enough variety to I think entice all of our listeners. So that's really exciting. And yeah, thanks again, Adam, for taking time out to do this. I really appreciate it. It was like such a joy to kind of go over the book with you, especially since I finished reading it about sometime last week. So it was really nice to kind of look back at some of the arguments and appreciate the elegance and the sophistication once again.
Oh, thank you so much on behalf of both me and Tarek, and just really appreciate, you know, your time and reading the book so carefully. And yeah, I enjoyed the conversation so much. Thank you.